I remember one day, today's going to be very practical. I remember one day I was walking through the church, and when new people would come to our church from other churches, I kind of had a rule, and it was that I wasn't going to let you talk bad about your previous church unless there was a crisis that happened and you're really working through something. But if they just wanted to tell me, you know, I don't like my pastor, he was a jerk, blah, 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 I would just say, you know what? In fact, you could steal this. We would give every member an uncut key at membership. And when we would give it to them, we would say this: this key represents two things. One, God is going to uniquely carve you for the doors of opportunities of ministry here that he's going to open. And it might be different than what you've done in the past, because we were like Pastor Jim. We wanted you in your proficiency pain and passion. Thank you. I almost said it wrong. Good grief. I do listen. We wanted you in that, and so don't come here and just say, I've always played guitar, and that's what I'm going to do here. You might not play guitar here. God might have a new plan for you. And the second thing is this, I would say to them, and here's another thing. You get to start over. Nobody knows all the things that have happened in your life. Nobody knows all the mistakes you made. And also, I get to be a pastor who starts over from your previous experience. Don't carve the key of what happened in the past to my heart. Steal that. It's really good. It's really cheap, and people go, wow, and it's an opportunity to tell people to get over their past and move on. Okay? And so I was walking through the hall one day, and this new couple came, and I was walking up near the kids area. They had kids going to kids area, and as we're walking, the guy says, yeah, we've been coming for about 3 weeks, Pastor. We really like it here. We came from such and such church, and man, that guy drives me nuts. And I'm walking, and here's a kid from our church who's probably about 11. And I started to kind of go, you know, and the kid goes, hey, Pastor, I got this. Said, what? And before I could find out what he was going to say, he says to them, hey, just so you know, we don't do that here. And the people said, what? He goes, we don't talk bad about other churches or other Christians, because that's not how God talks about us. That day changed me as a pastor. I'm going to tell you why. I asked this question of my staff. What was it inside an 11-year-old kid that understood the culture of our church so strongly that he was confident enough to address an adult he didn't know, and he did so very well with kindness, but also firmness? And I started to go down a journey in my spirit of how we could do church in a better way. We've talked about the three areas Pastor Jim talked about. We talked about, you know, our passion for Christ last night and how we don't want paper towns. We laughed a little bit, how we get to do this. I want to talk to you about something I think God wants to do. Now, I led a large staff and a large church, pretty good sized church. But I want you to know what was the beauty of Freedom Christian that I pastored for in 23 years was this. We had a 75% serve rate, defined as every person in that 75% was serving in one meaningful area of ministry every single week. 75% serve rate. You know the rule, 20% does 80% of the work? Not at my church. And by the way, can I just tell you, the more you get people connected to the mission and the vision and the passion, the more your income automatically goes up. People will give to vision. People will give to things they believe in. They won't give to things they don't understand. So if you get up and do a vision statement and say, we're going to win our community, they're going to say, tell us how. And you go, that's your thing to figure out. They're going to go, eh. Because part of the art of being a leader is the ability to articulate vision and at the exact same time, tell us how we're going to get there and how we're going to do it together. And so we started down this road of trying to figure out how to do this. And I started to examine what I believe, and this will be in your outline, and then we'll get to this in a minute, and I'll move this out of the way so you all can see, that there's four really kinds of pastors. And I'm going to be honest, and I think if you're honest, you'll see this too. At some point, you were probably one or two of these, and it's changed. The first is, there's the do-it-all pastor. They do everything and really enjoy doing everything. How many know that season of ministry? Some of you are like, yeah, I'm a small church pastor. Can I just tell you something? I don't care about how big or small a church is. No matter what size you are, you should not be doing it all. It's not about hiring staff. It's about creating a culture in your church where people come alongside you. The excuse I hear all the time is, but I'm a small church pastor and I do everything. And my response to those pastors is, well, why are you doing that to yourself? They said, well, I don't have anybody else. I said, do you have people? I said, yeah. I said, do you know every person God created with a vision and a passion? Do you know that they're there in your church? You just have written them off before they had a chance to succeed at what God called them, or you had them in the wrong spot and they burnt out. So I was at this church and this pastor had told me that, and he says, no, you're wrong about my church. He says, why don't you come and preach on a Sunday? You'll find out what I'm talking about. So I came and preached. At the end of service, I talked about serving and giving your life. At the end of service, a line of people came up to the altar. And usually at churches, you guys might get this, you get the person who wants to know how to get credentialed, who should never probably be credentialed. I didn't say that out loud, but it's true. And by the way, I've learned every church has a worship leader. Not every church has a worship leader that can sing. But everyone thinks they're a worship leader. And so they came up, and one by one, this is what people started saying to me. I would really like to start a kids ministry. I know we don't have kids, but I would like to prepare a lesson every week, and I'd like to freshen up the nursery room, and I'd like to be there in the room acting as if we have kids, so when someone shows up with kids, I'm there. But pastor says we don't have kids, and I don't want to overstep my pastor because I dearly love my pastor, and he said that would be a waste of my time. And so what happened was 2 weeks ago, someone showed up with kids and they chased me down and had to find me, and it was clear we didn't have a vision for kids. Pastor, how do I help our pastor know that this isn't me trying to do something that's stupid, that this, and one by one. And so at the end of service, I took him out to eat and I said, Pastor, did you hear your church? He says, I heard that. I don't know where that came from. I said, they just needed someone who gave them permission to dream. When's the last time you allowed? Yeah, I know the fear. Hey, I never ever got up and said, we have 7 nursery workers that we need. Would you come serve? You'll always get the doers. You'll never get the leaders. And you'll always get people who are willing to do it. They're not the right people. Most of the time, and they quit 3 months later, and you end up with the same process repeated over and over and over and over. But I will tell you this, there is something different when you say to your church, I want you to dream about what God has for you. This is kind of tagging off Pastor Jim's, and I want you as a leader to not be threatened by the person who comes to you and says, hey, listen, I should be in youth ministry. And you're like, but you hate teenagers. Because what we don't want as pastors is to have to tell people no. But can I say this, pastors, and I want to say this kindly and nicely but firmly, you have got to grow up in your leadership and realize that's your job. It is not about abdicating responsibility or keeping the peace. Your job is to kindly, graciously, and leaders directed, say to them, I think... Ask the questions Jim did, and when you get to it, direct them to the right place. Pastors, stop letting your people sit in the seats and do nothing because you're afraid to have to tell them no. So we started down this road. What do we do? So these pastors sometimes are the do-it-all. And here's the problem. This is in your fill-in. Churches won't grow past, past the pastor's heart. Because what happens is at the core of that, let me say this to you, is there's a low level of trust the leader is offering to his congregants. Here's the truth. Pastors who like doing everything are sort of sending the message to their church, I don't trust you to do it as good as me. That's the reality. Number two, there's the try to do it with others, pastor. And why I say try is they still do everything, but they complain about it. It's not the one who enjoys it. It's the one who has to do it and then complains about it. True story. I show up at a church. The grass at the church is this tall. The pastor says to me, I don't know why our church isn't growing. And I said, well, I have one question. Do you have a lawnmower? He said, it's not a big property. It's fairly small. Most of it was building and parking lot and, you know, a little bit of grass. And he said, yeah, we have a brand new riding lawnmower. And I said, where is it? He said, in the shed. And I said, so why are you not cutting it? He goes, well, the board and I are in a fight right now. The board thinks it's my responsibility. That wasn't on my job description, and I think it's the board's responsibility. And I said, so I want to understand, you have a riding lawnmower that's brand new sitting in the thing, and you're wondering why your church isn't growing. And he says, do you think it's not growing because of grass? I said, no, I think it's not growing because of you and your board and your church. And he said, well, what do you think I should do about it? I said, give me the keys to the shed. And I got on the riding lawnmower and cut that guy's lawn. Took me about 25 minutes. Happened, God did a great thing. The board member who he was in a fight with pulled into the parking lot. He thought the pastor was cutting the lawn. He gets out of the car. The lawn has been cut. He gets out of the car. He sees it and he says, ha, finally. I said, no, sir, I cut that. He goes, who are you? I said, let me have a conversation. This pastor should have cut the lawn. The board member should have cut the lawn. They could have rotated one every other week. I don't care. Cut the lawn every 2 weeks, but at least cut the lawn. But the problem is, some pastors try to do with others, that's a board responsibility, and then they get mad when people don't do it the right way. Here's the problem. Churches won't grow past the pastor's ability. And it's still a low level of trust. Then there's the do-nothing pastor. This is a pastor who's been at a church for a while, gets mad, folds their arms, so to speak. They decide that they're going to do the bare minimum. This church deserves my preaching, and I'll give it my best in that. And what happens is the church will slowly decline. And can I say this, Pastor Mark, forgive me if I say this on the way out the door. It is astonishing to me how many pastors suddenly feel called to leave their church when they run out of money. I feel like I'm ready. God's calling me somewhere else. Tell me about your bank account. Well, we're out of money. Oh, I see how God is sitting in heaven going, when you get below $1,000, I'm going to call you to another church. And what happens is many pastors will protect their income, their position, while the church is crumbling around them. And they have no trust because they stand around and believe it's everybody else's fault but theirs. Pastors, is that okay to say? And then there's the do it through other leaders. And this is really risky. It's where the pastor is sort of the quarterback, throws the ball, lets somebody catch, and they run. But here's the problem. If you're going to be the quarterback who throws the ball to someone else, you've got to throw, Doug Clay calls this, a catchable pass. You don't just throw Hail Marys and hope something happens. You have to be able to throw a catchable pass that somebody knows. That means this: they get the vision, they have the resources that you can provide, they know what is expected, and you get out of their way and release them in their giftings because they're probably better at that than you. And I had to decide what I was. There was a season where I was a do-it-all pastor and I loved it. I called that my hero ball season. Can I be frank? I wanted everyone to know how hard I worked, how diligent I was. I wanted the respect of the blue-collar Detroiters who came to my church. I wanted them to know their pastor was going to work as hard as them. And I realized later that was pride, and I was doing something worse. I was stealing the opportunity for God to use other people. Then there was the season where I was to try to do it with others, and I got mad. I'd walk in the room and I'd say, hey, this is a great setup, but I have a question. Wouldn't it be better if we did all this way? And I remember when my admin looked at me and said, oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood when you put me in charge that you wanted me to lead this. So we have a choice. I'll either go home and you take over, or I'll do what you asked me to do and you'll get over yourself. I said, yes, ma'am. And she was real close. We're real close friends. I don't suggest your admins talk to you that way typically, but she could. So I decided to get honest about myself and decide to be the kind of leader that was willing to take risks. And to do so, I had to become very truly honest about who I was as a person, as a leader. Here's what I started to learn, a couple things. I learned that I led through my strengths and I reacted through my deficiencies. When it was about vision, I was all in. When it was about the threat to the vision, I was insecure. Some of you are like, you're insecure. God's done a good work in my life. I've become more understanding of whom I am. And the idea that a lot of my decisions in ministry early on were tied to, will it make so-and-so mad and will people like me? Will people like me will hold your church prisoner to the opinions of the negative people of your church, not the positive. And what happens is when high-level leaders come to your church and they watch their pastor succumb to the low-level opinions, because by the way, can I say this? Complaining is the lowest form of communication. It requires no thought. It requires no consideration. It requires no anticipation of the results. Criticism is the lowest form of communication because you can say it without regard for someone else. Do you know what's the highest form of communication? Is encouragement. That takes intentionality to notice, to pay attention, to identify, to see, to take time, to step out, to give that encouragement to someone else. It takes effort to be an encourager. It takes no effort to be a complainer. None at all. And so I started to realize that in my life, I was really good at, ready for this? Can I just be vulnerable? This is really early on in ministry. I was really good, and I still have moments of it that sneak up, at telling you how good I am at my job and how busy I am at my job and how hard I work at my job, because I just want you to know I'm working hard. And I still have that struggle every once in a while. Anybody else can admit? Good. There's some honest pastors in Minnesota. Michigan, we'd all be like, when you get outside, we're going to beat you. So that's what they do. They're a little bit more tough. And so I started to evaluate what I call my leadership philosophy. We're getting into your notes here. I want to talk to you about leadership philosophy, then we're going to get to this graph and we'll be done. A leadership philosophy is defined as a belief about people. A part of how your leadership philosophy is, and here's your fill-in, what do you truly believe about people on your team and in your church? What do you really believe about people? How you believe about people determines how risk adverse you are or how willing you are to step into risk to do something amazing with other people. What do you really believe? Do you believe here's what happens at a lot of churches. You get comfortable with the small group of really capable. So every time a ministry position opens, you go to the same group of people to get them to do the same things. And when somebody says, what about Jim? Your first response is, nah, I've seen Jim lead this. He's not the guy. And pastors pigeonhole large percentages of their churches to the stereotypes of their past experiences. And it's almost like, watch this, don't want to step on toes this morning. I'm trying to be just neutral today, but let me say this to you. It's almost like we believe the gospel of grace applies to us, but not to anyone else. Yeah, you led this ministry and you didn't do well. What if you put them in the wrong ministry? What if that was your fault, not their fault? What if you came across and said, hey, I need you to help me. And they said, I love you, Pastor, I'll do it. And they willingly step into something that God did not design them to do, and it doesn't go well, and then you blame them for the lack of success while God's going, hey, pay attention to who's in front of you. You put them in the wrong spot. It's also about the next one. What do you truly believe about different generations' work habits? Pastors, can I say this to you? Knowledge about generations is good. Holding every generation to your generation's work ethics is very wrong. I got a worship guy who joined my staff. He's now the worship pastor at Grand Rapids Assembly of God, or First Assembly, Drew McElhaney. When Drew came on my staff, Drew was young. He was 22. Super talented, and he said to me, what time do we open the office? I said, we're in around 8:30, and he says, I don't know if I can stay up that late. I said, what do you mean? He goes, I like to sleep, but I'll be in at 11, and I don't have any kids, and I'm not married, and I'd rather do 11 to 7 because that fits my natural thing. Are you okay with that? And my first internal reaction as a Gen Xer is, what did I just hire? I'm okay with the V-necks, the deep Vs, the navel Vs. I'm okay with the skinny jeans. I'm okay with your floppy haircut. I'm okay with all that. What do you mean? I'm going to be here at 8:30 and you're not. That was my first reaction, but the Lord corrected me and I said, let's try this. I will tell you, he was the most productive staff member I ever had. He was the greatest challenger of things. Things got done. He was like the Holy Spirit. I'd walk in the room. I knew he was there, but I didn't even always see him. But there's a lot of pastors who don't even understand their volunteers or their staff well enough to know that you've got to get out of their way and let them work. As long as the work gets done well, you don't have to make them work like you work. Because here's the problem. Many of us have terrible work habits. Every volunteer that shows up to serve in your church is on their first hour of overtime from the week they've already had. And when they walk in your door, if you require them to function and think, now there's requirements and there's guidelines, but if you're trying to shove people a round peg into a square hole, you're going to constantly have turnover and you're going to have 30% of your church serving instead of 75% of your church serving. And I've learned this, my mom used to say this, every generation needs to get over itself. I like that. And she passed away, as you know, so you can't challenge that because I'll punch you. Here's part of the thing. Do you believe people really want you to succeed? How you view people, how you view volunteers, how you work, view the people in your church will create a culture. And I see this a lot. There are pastors who've created a culture where it is almost like protect the pastor's emotions at all cost. Don't let anybody, if someone asks a question, hey, pastor, that sidewalk wasn't, oh, don't go to pastor with that. And the staff and the volunteers begin to manage the church to protect the pastor instead of building the vision of the church. Because the pastor at the core of their nature has this question, are people out to get me? Here's the answer to that. Yes. Can we just accept at some point in ministry, someone's going to come after you? Let me say it again. And that's your job as the leader to navigate that. I would love to say I never had anybody mad at me. That's not true. When we took away the flags on that one Sunday when they got out of control, oh my word. I mean, oh my word. I might need counseling. It's coming back to me. Second part of a leadership philosophy is what are the principles that guide your decisions, actions, trust, and delegation? It's what you think about people. And it's what you do with that information that guides your decisions. Can I tell you this? Principles don't change. They might evolve, they might be added to, but they don't change. You gotta stay true to your core. See, there's a difference between core and culture. I might help all you pastors right here. I learned this about 5 years into lead pastoring and it changed our culture. Your people do not have to agree with all your decisions. Second part of that, and I'm gonna expand on that. Second part of that is this, your people don't love, nobody in your church loves 100% of your church. The reason they stay at your church is they like more than they don't. 60% I like the church, I stay. 49% I don't like the church, they go. So your church is filled with people who you think, hey, they come and they serve. They love everything we do. And we're often caught off guard when we find out they don't. Here's what you need to assume. Almost every person in the church doesn't like something about your church. And here's the good part. You don't either. Pastors, you don't like everything. I used to say this to my church all the time. Everything outside of doctrine and spirituality is an experiment. And I want you to know, you won't like everything that we do in this church, and that's okay. I don't like everything we do in this church. And people would say, well, what is it you don't like? I said, I'm not going to tell you because that's not my place because I have leaders in there and it works. It's more about does it work and is it what God wants than it is about my preference. See those talking points? How you're teaching your church as you lead? Hey, listen, I have to get over things too, just like you. Just like you. But there's a difference between core and cultural things, not culture outside of the church. I mean your church culture. Can I just tell you, when you paint a wall, people don't have to like the color. And if you make that a core issue, your church will die. Pastor, I hate that color. Yeah, I'm sure some people like it. I'm sure some people hate it. I'm not sure. So I don't have to like the color? Nah. I remember when we were expanding a parking lot, a guy comes up to me and he says, I hate that we're putting money into a parking lot. I hate parking lots. I said, yeah, I understand. He says, I'm not giving a dollar to it. I said, you don't have to. You tithe, you're faithful. You served on our board before. You don't have to like the parking lot. Well, then, Pastor, why are you so passive? I said, because I'm not requiring you to like the parking lot. And he says, well, why are we doing this? I said, well, we're not really building a parking lot. What we're really doing is we're giving an opportunity that someday a car pulls in that might have a girl that could marry your grandson, and I sure hope they have a parking spot so that your family ends up getting, your grandkid finds their spouse. I said, what we're actually doing is your daughter, who is away from the Lord, if she showed up on a Sunday morning, we want her to be able to find a parking spot so she can come in and experience Jesus. So we're not really building a parking lot. We're building an opportunity for people that you might care about to have a blessing in their life. But listen, I just want to let you know, if you don't ever give a dollar to it, that's fine. We're still going to do it. But I don't care if you give to it. He starts crying. He goes, I expected a fight with you today. I said, well, you're not getting one. Do you know who gave the biggest check to the parking lot? Because I think a lot of times we create our own problems in our church because we're willing to get into the fight because we make cultural issues a core issue. If someone came to me and said, Jesus isn't the Son of God, that's a core issue, we're going to talk. If someone comes up and says, Pastor, I don't like the way your jeans look on you on a Sunday, that's fine, you don't have to like it. Well, are you going to change it? Probably not, but it's okay that you don't like it. When you give permission, listen, pastors, when you give permission for people to have an opinion without judgment, that's appropriate. There are some conversations. You eliminate 80% of the gossip that occurs, because if they can't talk to you, they'll talk around you. The greatest thing you can do to create a culture in your church of health is to not be touchy about everything. I had a guy call me and he says to me, I hate everything you're doing as a superintendent. I said, that's okay, that's fine. And he says, I was one of the people who voted against you this year. I said, that's fine. I didn't think we voted against people. I thought we voted for people, but that's fine. That's fine. And he says, so are you going to blackball me from ministry? I said, no, you're a very good minister and I'm excited about what God's doing in your ministry. And he says, oh. We sat there. He says, is there anything else you want to say? I said, no, man, tell me what's going on in your family. How's your family doing? And he goes, why do you care about my family? I said, listen, man, I care more about you than what you do, and I certainly care more about our relationship than me in this role. He got quiet. He says, I got to go. I'm at one of our conferences at the altar, and a hand hits my shoulder. And I've had people pray for me. I have never had someone pray for me like he prayed for me. I said to him afterwards, I said, man, that was a wonderful prayer. He says, after I went home, I thought to myself, if that man's not going to be touchy about me being a jerk to him, then maybe I'm just a jerk. And now he's my friend. I've preached in his church. When he introduced me, here's how he introduced me. I want to introduce you to our superintendent, a man that was kinder to me than I've ever been to him. And this is a man I can trust, and so can you. See, pastors, we're fighting over stupid things. Don't take the bait. See, too many leaders begin to lead. Here's a fill-in. You're seeing the long list. It moves faster in just a second. Too many leaders lead their team out of protection instead out of purpose. You're protecting something instead of leading out of purpose. So here's the point. You all have a leadership philosophy. You have to define it. I can't define it for you. You have to. How do you think about people? How do you view people on your team? How do you view next generation's work ethics above you or below you? Are you leading out of protection or out of purpose? And here's the truth. If you don't know your leadership philosophy, here's the sad news. Everyone else in your church knows it already. They might not be able to articulate it. They know exactly how their pastor leads. And here's the worst part about leadership. You might experience this, Pastor Mark and Pastor Jim as well. The problem is when the church knows their leader and the leader doesn't know themselves, whew, that's a problem. Because the leader begins to lead oblivious to their own deficiencies, and the congregation sits there and goes, come on. You got to win the lost. Well, when's the last time you've done that, Pastor? When have you shared your faith? Do you know I go to the same 5 restaurants around my network office, and I did this when I was a pastor, every single time you have food with me? Jim will tell you we always meet at Red Robin. Red Robin's one of the places. I have a few other places I go to. Do you know why I do that? Because now when I walk in, the staff knows me and I know them. I know their name. They know my name. I know their stories. They know my stories. And guess what? Someday they're going to know his story. Amen. And the reason why is when I was a pastor, how could I ever on earth ask my people to engage in the culture if I was sitting in my office only around church people? So I would often take pictures and post on my Facebook wall. Hey, I'm at Big Boy having a conversation with so-and-so. I know Big Boy is like, I don't know. One of my staff came back and said, I got food poisoning. I said, what'd you do? He says, I ate the seafood buffet at Big Boy. I said, you can't be on my staff. You're clearly an idiot. You don't go to Big Boy and eat fish. Ew. Anyway, so I'm getting off track. I get back on. But here's the other problem. If you don't know how to define your leadership philosophy, you'll end up with an accidental one. If it's not on purpose, it will happen to you no matter what. I want to jump ahead to 4 questions that challenge you this. This is in your fill-in. This is 4 questions I ask myself regularly and leaders should ask themselves. Number 1, what do I really think about myself right now? This answers what's motivating you. This answer is what motivates you. Here's how you develop a leadership philosophy. You ask yourself, what do I think about myself? Do you know that most leadership philosophies are birthed out of an insecurity, a pain, or a problem that's unaddressed and unresolved in a person's leadership? Almost all of it. If you've had a bad board experience at one church and you go to a new church and that board member asks the same question but with a different spirit, you're thinking they're the same person that came that you had at the other church. And your natural reaction is to get defensive. You have to discover your leadership philosophy. Be very brutally honest. What do I feel and think about myself right now? You might discover you think too highly of yourself. If you say these statements, I've been in ministry for 30 years. I know how to do ministry. No, you don't. You know how to have done ministry, but ministry is not the same as it was 30 years ago. I told our parents at our church, stop telling your kids you know what it's like to be a teenager. Tell them this, I know what it's like to go through some of the emotions you have, but here's a better statement, I have no idea what it's like to go to school and have to do shooting drills. I have no idea what it's like to have social media in the classroom and be bullied online. I never experienced that. All the bullies I knew just punched me in the throat. By the way, my dad got a call one day. I was running an illegal gum, G-U-M business in the school. I was buying a pack for 25 cents, selling each piece for 25 cents. I was making $300 a week. The school found out and they almost prosecuted me. They demanded the money. My dad had to come in and negotiate a settlement. It was awesome. I don't know why I'm sharing it, but I'm just really proud of that moment in my life. I just feel like I needed to get that out there and let you know. And I've got some gum in the front row if you want some at the end of this thing. What motivates you determines how you lead. Number 2, what do I really think about them, people? This measures your honesty. What do I think about myself? What do I think about the people around me? And when you start to marry those two together, you'll realize every decision you're making is birthed mostly out of those two things. How I feel about myself and how I feel about others. Number 3, do I want to work with them or do I just want them to work for me? That is a fundamental difference of how you approach leadership in a local church. Do you view that people are there to serve the vision and you, or do you view you're there to serve their vision for their life and their passion? This measures your maturity. He said, are you calling me immature? No, I'm just saying this measures the depth of your growth. My job as a superintendent is not to be the leader of Michigan. It is to be the greatest unseen associate pastor and the greatest consistent for every church and the most consistent friend to every minister. That is my only two job descriptions I've given myself. I want to be the best unseen associate pastor to the church. I don't need credit. I don't need to be a part of things, but I'm going to go to war with that pastor for their vision. And it's going to look different in rural and urban and suburban and northern and east and west and south. It's going to look different. And the second thing I want to be is the most consistent friend to every minister. Why? Because my network's passion is my mission. The pastor's passion becomes my mission in every church I go to, and it's different every week. But you know what's not different? My desire to see their dreams happen. If ministry is about your dreams, that's a problem. And lastly, what's your long-term plan? This measures your commitment. You know, I was in a board meeting with a church board, and they said to me this. They said, you know, our pastor has threatened to quit multiple times. The pastor's in the room, and they said, you know, every time he gets upset, he says, maybe I should just leave. And you know what I said? I don't know if you're as bold as this. I said, hey, next time, Pastor, you say that, I'm encouraging this board to accept it. Pastor. And he says, what? And I said, that's emotional manipulation. You say that to get your way. It's like a temper tantrum. So I said, the next time you say, I think I should quit, everyone on this board needs to accept his resignation right now. Afterwards, the pastor says, I thought you were here for my vision and for me. And I said, I am. I just helped you more than you have any idea. And he says, well, they're mad at me. I said, no, they were already mad at you. Now, he says, but you gave them authority. I said, no, I taught you how to be a leader. You don't have temper tantrums in ministry. Oh, maybe I should quit. Good, do it. Save yourself and the church, the whole thing. You know why? Because you're not thinking about yourself right. You're not thinking about others right. Your maturity, your honesty, it's all low. And you can't lead from the low position. If you lead from the low position, someone from a higher caliber is going to take over your church. Do you know why we have board and pastor problems and why we have strong leaders? Is because somebody is leading stronger and higher than the pastor often is. And I don't mean by authority, I mean by integrity. I don't mean getting up there and bullying your church and blah, blah, blah. I'm talking about integrity. I remember when a guy came to our church, he was mentally ill. God healed him miraculously, found out he had been a pastor of a 4,000 person church. I didn't know this. He'd been in our church for years. He got totally healed. He comes to me and he says, hey, you know, my passion is new believers. I said, oh my word, we have so many. Would you mentor them? He did a phenomenal job for 2 years. Then he turned on us. Violently. Awfully. I think he wanted a staff position down the road, and that wasn't going to happen because we weren't in that spot. So on a Sunday morning, I didn't know this was happening. I have 20 people from a new believer's life group that he was leading. I was leading a couple. He was leading a couple too. And they came to me right as I'm about to go into service. And I had the email he had sent me. He had left our church. He had sent emails out to everybody. You know, the whole thing. And he had sent me an email. And in that life group, he had given me a paragraph about the deficiencies of every one of them as people. So this group comes to me and they said, Pastor, something's wrong with your leadership. This guy had been a trusted friend for a year. He had mentored us. He left the church. He told the group that you told him he wasn't allowed to tell people why he would leave. No, I didn't. And they said, we don't know if we can follow your leadership. Right on Sunday morning, I'm about to walk on stage. I had the email I could have held up and said, let me show you what he thinks of you. But instead, here's what I said. Because my leadership philosophy had already been determined. I was never going to do that because we don't do that here. So here was my response. I said, listen, you know me, and you have to decide if what he said about me sounds like me. And if it doesn't sound like me, then I need you to ignore it and let's move on together. If it does sound like me, you probably need to go find another church where you could find a pastor who you can believe in. And I'll gladly love you, because I want you to know I wouldn't go to a church if I didn't believe in the pastor either. And I walked on stage. Not one of those people ever left the church. Several of them became leaders in our church. And years later, I said to them, hey, remember that? They said, yeah. I said, why did you stay? They said, because while everybody else was, while he was bashing you, you had integrity. Most conflicts get resolved if you live principally before the decision and the conflict arises. Are you with me? Is this making sense? Okay, I'm going to do this chart, and so you're going to need to see this, okay? So here's this diagram, and I want to show you what I think happens in churches. And this is the final little stretch here. I know we have about 10 minutes still, is that right? Or do you need something else to do? Okay, we're good. That's a dumb thing to ask the guy. What's he going to say? Yeah, get off the stage. I shouldn't do that to him. I shouldn't do that. Let me just say this to you. Here's what most pastors make a mistake on. We start with information. So let me take men's ministry. You need a men's director in your church. Here's what pastors mostly do. We say, hey, I think Bob is a good leader. Bob loves men. Bob shows up to the, how do we define how Bob loves men? He shows up to the breakfast every other Saturday and he seems to enjoy it. And we like him. Can I be honest? That's often the leadership requirements that a lot of pastors put on leaders. They're faithful. I like them. I trust them. They eat biscuits and gravy. So we go to Bob and we say, Bob, here's what I want you to do to run men's ministry. I want you to do a monthly activity. I want you to do this event. Once a year, I'd like to have a men's retreat. Here's your budget, all that stuff. And what happens is Bob is a good man, and maybe Bob is the right guy. And let's say Bob is the right guy. Bob takes all the information that you have given to them. And then Bob starts to do this. He only wants to imitate everything you told him to do. He's going to do the monthly meeting. He's going to stay within that budget. He's going to do the annual men's retreat. He's going to do everything he can because he loves his pastor, he loves his church, and he believes he loves men in men's ministry. And so he is going to do everything he can. And I call this right side leadership. Okay? This is how we did our whole church on servanthood, okay? So here's what happens. The pastor leaves that meeting, the guy says, I'm in, and the pastor leaves and goes home and says to his spouse, ha, we got a men's director, it's all taken care of. Pastors, I think I'm gonna hit a nerve right here. What happens every time Bob has a problem? He runs right back to you for more information. Pastor, I need to know what to do. The men's breakfast is down to 12 people instead of 14. Pastor, we lost $10 on the last event. What do we do? So what do? As a pastor? You give him more information. And we start this continual process of the pastor getting information, giving information, receiving, and we stay on the right side. And here's what happens. After a while, if you're a lead pastor or a youth pastor or a kids pastor, you have this moment where, if you may have said this, let's be honest in a second, I'm gonna ask you to raise your hands. Why can't anybody just do what I told them? Why does Bob keep coming back to me and asking me these questions? It doesn't do me any good for Bob to be in charge when I'm doing all the work. Pastors? And we get frustrated and we make this ultimate statement. Why doesn't anybody in our church dream? And what we center is every dream, every thought, and every vision has to come from the office of the person in charge. Now, this is left side leadership. And I'm going to show you this. Left side leadership, here's the different approach. You think Bob might be the guy, but you don't know. So you schedule a lunch with Bob and you sit down and you do some of Jim's questions and others. Hey, Bob, how you doing? You have a conversation. You see how Bob interacts. Then you say, hey, Bob, we got a men's ministry. What are we doing well? What do you think we could do better? Tell me your thoughts. If Bob is the leader and Bob has a passion, Bob will have some thoughts. He might be hesitant at first to share it because he doesn't want to overstep his friend who's leading it or used to lead it. But you say, Bob, this isn't a criticism. I don't want to talk about people. I just want to know, what could we do to reach the heart of men? And Bob begins to unpack. Here's what I think we should do, Pastor. I think we should maybe go away from the Saturday breakfast, and I think we should go to this, and I think we could do this. Or really, Pastor, men just want to hang out. Maybe we just have men's life groups, whatever. And what happens then is the leader then receives the information from Bob. And if the leader feels Bob's the guy, he then approaches Bob and says this, Bob, I'd like you to be our men's director. And Bob's first question is going to be, what do you want me to do? Here's left side leadership. Bob, I want you to do everything you told me. Here's your budget. Still involves information. But Bob, I want your vision to be the vision for men's ministry. Why does this change? Because when Bob has a problem, you've empowered Bob to be an innovator. Bob now has a dream. He has a passion. It's aligned with his giftings. Bob has something deep inside his soul that he says he can do. And here's what happens. Watch the brilliance of this idea. On the right side leadership, you always will say, I want people to be innovators. I want people to dream. But they will never do that because the goal of leadership is to make sure they only do what pastor told them. But here's the beauty. On the left side, Bob now will build a team. And Bob will build a team of imitators. But guess what they're imitating? Innovation. They are now saying, hey, Bob's our leader. Bob told me we can dream. Bob gave me a dream. Bob has a dream. Bob invites them into the dream. Why? Because he's an empowered leader by the lead pastor. And eventually, here's what happens. Bob will come all the way back to pastor and say, Pastor, I need a meeting with you. Here's what my team has been dreaming. And guess what your job is? Navigate, no, that doesn't work, this works, yeah. And then you say, Bob, go do it again. I think the reason a lot of our churches are dying is because we're living on the right side where the pastor is the source of all information, sharing every idea, having to answer every question instead of producing innovators. And I will tell you, we went from 27% serve rate to 75% serve rate when we started switching our focus to creating innovators, not imitators. Does this make sense? And it is going to cost you every part of your thought process. Because the natural thing is, who should do that? Just go get so-and-so. They'll do it. No, 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 no. And so on our staff, we started talking, are we right side or left side leadership right now? And I will tell you, the natural gravitational pull is always to the right. It is unnatural to go to the left. It is absolutely natural to go to the right. But if you work at this, something came to life in our congregation. Our people started serving. We started attracting high capacity leaders who started to show up. And so the goal, this is your fill in, the goal of your leadership is to produce inspired leaders. When you do left side leadership, you end up with inspired leadership. You end up with people, and that's the number, next one. I want your teams to be inspired. That's the center of the triangle, that when you have a left side innovative thing, they're always inspired. You actually have to kind of catch up to your team who runs ahead of you. Pastor Jim and I were talking. His team came up with this crazy fifth Sunday idea. They built a spaceship, and Jim was doing multimedia stuff in an astronaut costume, and it was weird, and he said, I don't know if it's going to work, and it was beautiful. But it wasn't Jim's idea, was it? No, it was not. If it was, I apologize. But Jim was the one who had to do it, but his team dreamt it up. I remember when Jim was telling me how he was resistant to going to online church and how his team had to kind of convince him. And now they have how many viewers a week? But it was thousands, mega thousands. And he still has no idea why. Because innovators are running with it. Is this making sense? Right side leadership is based primarily on information, that's a fill-in, and produces followers rather than innovators. Right side leadership Our left side leadership, go down to your next one, is based primarily on innovation, and it produces creative, dynamic teams. It's the difference between having doers and dreamers, designers or managers. I remember when we came up with this crazy idea, we decided that we were going to put the same sound system equipment in our kids' church that we had in our Sunday morning worship center, and it was going to cost us tens of thousands of dollars, because our goal of the worship, of the sound booth, was we have a generation that we want to be proficient so we never run out of the best people who've done it. And we came up with a goal. The innovators in my church said, we want 8 years of experience by the time someone's 18. So we started a program. We bought all the same, I mean, the same Behringer board, all the lighting things. And I will tell you, 8 years later, we had 27 sound and lighting people. We could barely get them serving because we had so many people, and most of them were 18 or under. In fact, on Christmas Day, we had two 12-year-olds run our entire lighting and production system, including our online service, because we had been training them for 2 to 3 years prior. And so our sound ministry grew. So now all our ministries start saying, we want to do that. So every leadership meeting we had, guess what? Every leader was required to bring a leader with them, a leader in training. And those leaders would sit at the table and say, why am I at this leadership gathering with the pastor? And the pastor knows my name. He knows where I go to school. If they're young, he knows where I work. What am I doing here? And then we'd have this moment where we would say, what do you think? And they'd say, I'm not a leader. I said, yes, you are. You just don't know where you're serving yet. Talk to us. And we would have 17-year-olds speaking to the entire leadership team of our church. And the dynamic of our church started to become so innovative that I got to have a very easy job. My job got easier and easier and more fun and more enjoyable. I had people knocking on my door. Pastor, I've got an idea for single moms. They're carrying their kids in the rain. We need to put parking spots over here. How much would it cost to put some signs, get some really big umbrellas? How much would it cost to do this? I said, well, you want to change a parking lot? That's about $30,000. They said, I'll write the check. Next Sunday, I get to come up and say, hey, we now do this for single moms. Single moms start crying. Somebody sees that and says, hey, listen, what about elderly people? I think we need to do this. And then it just snowballs. And next thing I know, money's coming and vision's coming and people are coming. Why? Because somebody had a dream and they were permission given to do so. Because every great answer doesn't come from the senior pastor's office. And I know there are personalities, and so let me hit these in the next 5 minutes and I'm done. You're like, there's a lot on here. It goes quick. How do you do that? Because here's the problem. Yeah, but you don't know my people. People are people. Number one, truly care about people more than process. Truly care about the people who serve in your church. Care about them with everything you have. Number two, be authentic and transparent with your life. Can I encourage you? Let your yes be yes and your no be no, and don't be inconsistent. Number three, win their hearts before you go after their hands. You know, one of the biggest mistakes is we try to get people right side leadership into serving. Can I encourage you? When you win their hearts, their hands will follow. Number four, dream with them about their dreams, not just your dreams or the church's. Dream with them about what they're dreaming about. It's exactly what Pastor Jim talked about. Number five, respect them. Here's what I've learned. Mutual respect cultivates an attitude of appreciation, which results in hard work. Our church people worked so hard because their lead pastor would come up to them and say, hey, listen, I found out you're serving on three teams and you've got four young kids at home and your wife has got some chronic illness. What team is the one that's your and I would steal Jim's language, what is your proficiency in pain and what is it that your passion is? And we need to get you out of these because we care more about what you do than care about you than what you do. And I can't tell you the number of emails I got from spouses calling and saying, or calling or emailing saying, hey, thank you for caring about my family more than the church. Care about them. Number six, don't be threatened by ideas or those who have them. Don't be threatened by other people's brilliance. Number 7, be a receiver, not just a transmitter. Seek people out. Find out what they're thinking. Learn to grow alongside them. Number 9, watch their work, but give them space. They don't have to do everything the way you do. Set the goal and let them run in their passions. Number 10, and I'm going to spend 2 minutes on this. Know the difference between idea generation and idea evaluation processes. Pastors, if I can say this to you real quick. Idea generation and idea evaluation. Let me say this real quick. Have you ever been in a meeting where someone starts dreaming and there's always that person in the room who wants to tell you why it won't work? Do you know the greatest thing that stifles innovation and left side leadership is trying to do both in the same meeting? When you do that in the same meeting, it destroys it. So here's what I did. My staff meetings worked like this. The first Sunday of the month, or first Monday of the month, or Tuesday of the month was our meetings. The first Tuesday of the month, I wanted to know from them some ideas. We idea generated. Then we evaluated for a week, and on week 3, or week the next week, sorry, we would come back and we'd evaluate, but we didn't dream. If you try to do both all the time at the same time, you're going to create tension and frustration points and you're going to waste time. Not every idea gets done, but every idea deserves to be considered long enough to determine life or death. But when you evaluate, they take over and crush the spirit of the dreamers. Are you with me? Number 11, create a cause. People want a cause. And so lastly, there's this question. Well, but how do I know the difference between irritators and innovators? Pastor, these people, this sounds great, but these people seem irritating to me an awful lot. Yep, they will. They will. Let me give you some common characteristics in real quick. They're all there. Innovators tend to be very passionate. Here's the problem. So do irritators. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But sometimes we're negating a dreamer and an innovator because they sound too passionate, so it feels like criticism. When you hear that, don't decide negative. Listen closely to the intent of what they're saying to help separate between true passion and just obnoxiousness. Number 2, innovators ask questions. Here's the difference between innovators and irritators. Irritators come with solutions before they ask questions or ask setup questions to get to their solution. Innovators want to understand. I've learned that. When an irritator comes and says, why do you do that? And I say, well, I do it for these reasons. Well, have you thought of this? No, that's an irritator. Innovators say, Pastor, help me understand why we do that. How do you think that affects this group? Do you understand the difference? It's subtle, but we've got to be better at listening. Number 3, innovators think there always is a better way to do what's being done. Innovators always feel that way. So do irritators. The difference is innovators want to do it for the betterment of the whole. Usually irritators have a personal stake in their complaint. Number 4, innovators like change when it's meaningful and for purpose. Irritators tend to hate change. Innovators like change when it's meaningful and purpose. They hate change when it's based on neediness. Irritators don't want anything to change unless they're the one changing it. That's a difference between them. Are you with me here? I'm moving fast. Innovators see things and do things differently. Irritators tend to see things historically. Or hysterically. Number 6, innovators expect high levels of commitment and quality. Irritators want to protect their position. But innovators want us to do it well and do it right. Last couple. Innovators do not take shortcuts. Irritators create shortcuts. Innovators don't want shortcuts. They want to do it right, and they want to do it for the long haul. Innovators take risks in systems, and they're willing to take risks in relationships. So are irritators, but innovators risk the relationship to reap a great reward. Irritators risk a relationship to take charge. Two different things. Number nine, innovators understand innovation is not a one-time thing. Irritators tend to have a very singular issue. Number 10, innovators have a strong point of view, but want to have discourse and are willing to see another way. Irritators want to tell you what you're doing wrong, and they only see it one way. Number 11, last couple, innovators feel the need to be noticed, valued, released to dream, and identified, or else they will leave your church. Irritators want to be noticed, and that's about it. They like their title and their position. Number 12, innovators like to shake things up. So do irritators. Sometimes that's really hard to figure out the difference. Number 13, innovators often recognize what people need before the people do, or even the leader themselves. Here's a big difference. Irritators can't even recognize their own need. They just naturally feel something and they run with it. And last two, innovators are amazingly committed to the team. Irritators are not. Innovators are people who are committed to the success of you and the team. Irritators are not. And lastly, innovators always look for a solution. Irritators always look for the next complaint. So as you take a bold step, should you choose to, if this doesn't fit for you, consider this a stupid lesson. Don't worry about it. But I want you to know, when we change this, something came across generationally, something came across effectively, and God did something miraculously through our church. This is how I try to lead our network. You know, Jim, what's your vision? Like, Jim went to your CMN thing last night. He really just wanted pie, but he went to it. Jim's a consumer of information, and Jim will ask me questions. Probably today at lunch, he's going to ask me questions. Have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? I want to know what Jim's heart is, because I want to release Jim to do something. This has got to be, does this all make sense? And I think this is where most of the conflict is happening in a local church. So I just want to say thank you again for having us come here. There's no altar time. I don't know what to do. How many of you want to be imitators, irritators? How many of you are irritated right now because we're 4 minutes over? Pastor Mark, I'm sorry. But listen, let's do this well. As I started the first night, we get to do this. Let's do this well. Let's do this with everything we have. And let's give God all the glory. Amen.